This is part two of the interview with Lee Mason. Could you tell me about how you came to work at Tektronix?
Oh, all right. Well, I told you about my last job was at Clackamas, Oregon. Then I was had worked for the Sun Pacific for about a year and a half or so, and I decided I'd like to go back up to British Columbia, where I had two brothers up there. And we had lots of roots up in British Columbia. So I turned in my resignation and hopped on the train, went up to Vancouver, BC. Oh, you want to know about how I got on Tech? And worked there for from 1948 to 1956. Oh, good. So in the spring of 56, the Canadian railroads were a little behind the US railroads as far as dieselizing. When I worked up there, it was all big steam engines, up-to-date oil-burning steam engines, powerful brutes and fast. But so that meant, being as it was steam engines, they didn't pull long trains. A long freight train might be 50 cars. So then in early 1956, the diesel started coming in, which meant the trains could be a mile long, or 100 cars, or even longer. So when I was there was a lot of trains. So in the town I was working in, we had two daytime operators. We were so busy. The other guy was an old guy, 65 years old, ready for retirement. And I was what they called a temporary guy, even though I was there for 6 or 7 years. It was a temporary job. So I knew as soon as the diesels came in with the longer trains, they would abolish the temporary job. And being as I only had 8 years seniority, I'd be working out in the sticks again, like I was at Whicopee. So I thought, oh, I'll just go down to Portland and get a job because my brother-in-law had come down 2 years earlier and went to work for Tektronix. And he said there was a lot of work going on down here. So I was young and I knew if it didn't work out, the railroads were still busy. I could always go back on the railroad. There was 50 railroads in the States that I could have got a job for. So I come out in, it would be in April of 1956 and stayed with my brother John in North Portland. Caught, oh, borrowed his car and drove out to where I went was 6900 Southwest Barnes Road, which was the main place for Tektronix, and they had graduated from Hawthorne and moved out there. And now the 6900 building, there's one there now, about a four-story high building, but the building that I hired into was only one story, but it was a nice modern building. So I drove out there, had no trouble finding it, and went into the door. I can still visualize going in there. And there was the most attractive movie star girl at the desk that I'd ever seen. And so friendly, and so I told her I was applying for work. Okay, fill out these forms. And so then she said, okay, well, the way it works, we give you a little test. So Blanche Cook is our personnel person that will do that. So I waited for a few minutes, and Blanche Cook came in, probably a lady maybe 35 or so, very professional looking. She took me into an office where you put square pegs into holes and round pegs, things like that. Well, I was very good at that because I'd been a telegraph operator, so it went right through that, and she remarked at how well I did. And then little IQ tests and stuff. And so everything went swimmingly. And I noticed one thing they did that I don't know. While you were visiting them, they had three faces. They had a frown face, and they had a straight face and a smiling face. Just like, what is that? They call that smiley face now. This was way back in 56, just a circle, no color. So she checked mine, a smiling face. That was important. If you were a frowning, that would be a point or two against you. Because everybody at Tech was just like your long-lost friend. such a friendly group of people you mm-hmm. never met. So anyway, that was fine. Everybody, thing went good. So they said, we'll call you. So I was used to going and hiring up and being hired immediately. That was my railroad experience. So I went back to 7155 North Mobile, where my brother lived, and didn't get a call from a day or two. So a week went by, and we did a few things, you know. And then another week went by, and they never called me. So I noticed that Voigt Rubber, which was down, have you heard of Voigt Rubber?
No.
They're back in those days, they may be in existence now, they made all the basketballs and that kind of balls, and the name Voigt on them. It was like they worked with rubber and, mm-hmm. and leather, footballs, stuff mm-hmm. like that. And they're right down on that, what's that commercial street that goes out towards the airport?
McLaughlin?
No, by the tracks. But it doesn't matter.
Oh, Lombard. They're all,
pardon?
Lombard.
No, the one paralleling Lombard. When Lombard runs into that commercial street.
Oh.
It's where all the businesses are. Anyway, only about 4 or 5 blocks from where my brother lived. In Kenton, yeah. Actually.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So I went down there, and it was in a Quonset-type building, and hotter than the hubs of hell. But the office wasn't bad. So he took me back to show them making these balls, and there was rubber fumes and kind of like smoke in the earth, and it was a kind of a production line, people making these balls. And so I walked through there and then went in the office and took an application. So I go home, and this was in the morning. So I go home, and about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I get a call from Tektronix that, come on out, we're hiring you. And then about a half an hour, tomorrow, come out half an hour later, I got a call from Voigt Rubber that they were hiring me. So I said, well, I already have it. I don't know, I'd have been dead now if I'd have stuck with Voigt Rubber with all the fumes and stuff. So I was so fortunate. So then I went out, I guess I went out to interview for a job. Now they were hiring me, but where to place me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went into CRT, first of all, with Daryl Pennington, a fellow Canadian. He had been a professor at UBC, but I don't think he even knew I was a Canadian unless he recognized my accent, probably did. But anyway, I went through all the tube area. It was such a fascinating area, but even though I'd done a little burning, so I was a little familiar with torches, I guess I wasn't the fellow that he was particularly looking for. So then they took me over to Erwin Ashenbrenner, who was over the sheet metal department. And my brother-in-law knew Ash, we called him Ash, Ashenbrenner. Just died a few months ago, nicest guy he ever met. Anyway, so he turned me over to a wonderful supervisor. I'll think of his name in a minute. But anyway, so while the supervisor was showing me around, Irwin went to my brother-in-law and said, well, what do you think about Lee? Would he fit in with our... Oh, yeah, he said, he sure would. Okay. So then the supervisor said, yeah, it looked like I'd work out. So they hired me. And it was a very significant day. I didn't know it at the time. It was May the 4th, 1956. And my wife was born 13 years older on May the 4th.
Well, I was born in
1945.
I made it 1945.
So she would be about 11 years old then, whom I never met, of course. So, what was the next question then?
Well, you got hired and you went into...
Oh, all right.
Mm-hmm.
So then the next day, they took me into the paint shop. And a fellow by the name of Lee Miller, similar name to mine. Here I'm Lee Mason, he's Lee Miller. So every time they were paging Lee Miller, it was kind of noisy. I wasn't sure if it was me or him. I knew, why would anybody be paging me? But anyway, my job there was, they got a lot of oscilloscopes back from the military, it seemed like it was. that would get scuffed up somehow. So they would take all the sheet metal, which was considerable, off it, and the paint department would strip the paint and repaint it. And they'd even change colors a little bit to more of a military color. And they'd even upgrade them if they needed, you know, every month or two they were finding a way of improving
right.
them. So they'd update them and ship them out just as new because they were exactly the same as new. And so I was there for a day or two, and then they said they needed somebody to work on scope mobiles. Now, if you've looked in the book, you've seen scope mobiles, have you?
Mm-hmm.
They're the cart that has rails like this, and the scope sits on there. I'm sure you've seen them.
Mm-hmm.
So they needed somebody to work in the scope mobile department assembling. So that was one of my jobs, to take all these parts and screw them together and end up with a finished scope mobile. But not only did we assemble them, I had a wonderful lead man then, Ivan Arnold, terrific guy. And he showed me, he could see that I had some potential, I guess. So he showed me everything, and I was operating bending brakes and punching things. Every day he had me sawing something. Every day I was on a new piece of equipment and learning how to read these drawings. And I enjoyed it so much, I couldn't wait to get to work. And I was that way for about the first 25 years of tech, but not the last two.
Mm-hmm.
But so anyway, we were just booming. That's probably why they hired me. I think they were hiring anybody that came through the door. We were just booming. I was very close and possibly exactly the 1,000th employee at Tektronix.
Oh, really?
In that month, the next month, I guess it would be, at the end of the month, they announced how many scopes they had shipped. And that month, they shipped 1,000 scopes with only 1,000 people.
Wow.
And a lot of them were office people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how it was done. And the profit share was 40%. But previously, they had profit shares up to 70%. But now with so many people taken out of the profit, and the prices were very low, but these scopes, you heard before, were sold pretty much at cost plus, whatever they cost. That's the way the ships were built by Henry Kaiser. It was all cost plus. So I never worried about getting paid from the government, of course. And most of our stuff went to the government, too. Government labs. And so it seemed, if I remember right, I could be wrong on some of these things. It seemed like as they hired more people, then next month it would be 1,100. And then sort of like 1,200. And then it couldn't keep going at that rate, of course. I've forgotten when it maybe tapered off.
Mm-hmm.
But after 2 months, we were so busy that Ivan Arnold said, you know, we got to put a swing shift on. So I want you to take about 10 guys and put them on swing shift, a couple of new guys and a couple of these experienced guys, and you'll be the supervisor, called lead man, swing shift lead man. So I did that, went to work at 3:30 then, I think, and had a nice crew. Well, they all were helpful and did their work. And didn't have to read. The supervising, you still work. You didn't just stand around and supervise. So there was no problems. And then a couple of months later, Erwin Aschenbrenner came to me and said, you know, we need this space. So we've just built a new warehouse over by the tracks on, what's that street? Wanted to buy
Milliken
and
Hawken
and Milliken by the tracks there. The Max goes right by this warehouse. The warehouse is still there. So I was the first guy that occupied maybe 10,000 square foot of warehouse with my little group just in one small section of it. Well, now instead of building these scope mobiles from scratch, where we made all the parts, bent them all up and formed them, all I was going to do was assemble them. So all I had was two other fellows and myself. So, and I had to work just as hard as all three of us were building these things. We built, for the 2 years that I did this, every day we built 20 scope mobiles. Every day. There was never a hiccup. There was a man over at in building 19, which was that first one I was in. Building 19, Gene Cavanaugh, make a note of his name. Mm-hmm. He was the scheduler. And he'd call me up about once a week and say, "Now, Lee, how are you fixed for the rails?" Those rails are these big aluminum things that were the handle. And anything else that you need? No? Well, yeah, we need some more drawers. We need some more felt. Okay. So there was never once in 2 years that those parts weren't in the warehouse mm-hmm. for me. When we went on computers, hey, not I wasn't in this department, things would get so screwed up. But he did such a wonderful job of that. So that I remember Erwin Ashenbrenner, after about a year, he called me over and gave me a fabulous raise. In fact, I don't think he should put this on there. But he told me that he gave me the biggest raise he had given anybody under him since he was running the place. It was still probably only 25 cents an hour, but the typical raise was, well, when he started out, was 5 cents, and then maybe 10 cents. Right. If you're lucky, you'd get 15 cents. So that would be 1957 when I got that 2-bit raise. So then he said, you know, so at the about December of 1958, he said, you know, we need some management over in the plastic department on the swing shift. They're expanding greatly. Mm-hmm. So we're going to have a swing shift there instead of just a day shift. So I'd like you to go over and be manager of that. Actually, not manager. They called us supervisors. Okay. So I went over there and started work, I think, about January 5th, 1959, yeah. It was a good year. So I started out there, and I remember the main man was Duncan Bergeron, a real sharp guy, but sort of a different guy. He was a little higher level manager. He was a unit manager, which is fairly high, and then under him would be a manager, and then under him would be a supervisor like me. But he was a hands-on guy, mm-hmm. which at that level you usually weren't hands-on. You wore a suit and maybe a tie mm-hmm. and a white shirt, but he liked to dress up. So I'm on swing shift. So he stayed late. So the biggest machine we had was what was called a 4-ounce Moslow injection molding machine. It was quite huge for only being 4 ounces. Now, I'm in the molding business now, mm-hmm. and a machine that was the same physical size as that Moslow was would be like a 12-ounce machine, because they made them much better. They didn't need them so super heavy. Mm-hmm. Everything was made so heavy. Anyway, the way he showed me, took me to the machine and showed me how it worked, about 5 minutes. And it was a tricky job, because I had to take these probe cylinders that were about 2 inches long, a half inch diameter, made out of aluminum. And it was a 6-cavity die, which means I had to have the gate open, little safety concern, and put these on core pins, 6 of them, close the gate, press a button, and then adjust the pressures and stuff, and then it would shoot. Well, the first one, he did one, and then just walked away, went home. So then the way the idea was, I would run this machine when I wasn't busy supervising other people. So, but he told me, just cool it down a little bit, and then you can come back to it. So I cooled it down a little bit and helped some of the people. I had a crew of about 20 people running hand machines and drill presses and what else did they run? Tapping machines and inserting machines. A lot of tricky jobs. So then after everything seems to be smoothed out there, I go back and raise the heat to get it up to about, it was a nylon, which is a tough material to run, which nobody told me. If it gets moist, it absorbs moisture. So just sitting around, waiting for an hour for me to run, the material is in a hopper, but it's an open hopper, and it's going to be absorbing just small amounts of moisture. So I put these 6 inserts in there, closed the gate, and jacked up the pressure a little bit and punched the button. And it was about a 30-second cycle, so after 30 seconds it opens up. And the parts are all there. And I think I might have even... they ejected. But they were still on the sprue. But they all had little silver streaks on them. So, gosh, what's that? Set it aside, I knew it, you know. Because you take the silver streak with your thumb and it would peel off. So I put it on, did a couple of the same things. So I turned the heat off and set it down. The next day, when I came to work, I asked the guy, not Dunk, he was gone, but the regular day foreman. Oh, he said, that's moisture in the material. And so if your work is some material, you don't need to worry about moisture. Like the stuff they make milk bottles out of, polyethylene, polypropylene. Even ABS, although we dry ABS quite, even though it doesn't need it that much, maybe a little bit. But nylon, you're always drying it. Polycarbonate, you can never get all the moisture out of it. The biggest problem with injection molding is moisture. We still have it in our molding company. Biggest problem, we think we have the state-of-the-art dryers, but it's still once in a while there's moisture. Okay, so I got started with Tet there. Now
so
I'm in the.
What happened? Did you figure out how to keep the moisture out of it?
Well, yeah, we had dryers there. But they had dried the material, but just sitting in the hopper, you have to have a lid on it. But these things you learn, you know. So, I found that very interesting too. My goodness sakes, that was interesting. So then we had a man come down from Boeing. The department was getting big, and Duncan Bergeron, good man, but he's a hands-on guy, and I think the upper guys thought, well, they needed and he had worked his way up and learned the business just by doing it. So they figured they needed a professional plastic engineer in there to be the top guy. So they brought down Jim Sayre, S-A-R-E, I believe, from Boeing. And real nice guy. And he wasn't there about a week that he wanted to firm up the quality control. So he made me a unit manager in charge of quality control for plastics. A pretty big step up from about a range 9 to range 12. And gave me a nice raise. He seemed to have a lot of faith in me. And just left me alone to my own resources. So I just hired promoted a couple of people from the floor to be with me. And I think we did a very effective job. What happened later on? So I was doing that for a year or two as a quality control manager. And then something very significant happened. Well, we moved into a different part of the building. We were in the south side of the building. We moved over to the north side, much bigger area, brought in a whole bunch of molding equipment, real nice Arbergs, they were called. Nice, they were about 2-ounce machines, maybe 1.5-ounce, about a dozen of them. And we had lots of different managers, Cal Smith. My favorite manager in the plastic department then, I'm talking about 19, but we were married then,
We got married in 1970.
So this would be maybe... Oh, no, it was before that. I was thinking John Kennedy came through our plastic department. And so that would be, when he was running for office, what would that be? 1962, wasn't it? So, yeah, we were over in this newer part on the north side in 1962. My office is right where he goes from one office into where the injection molding is. And here comes David Brinkley. There would be a Secret Service guy in front of him, but you wouldn't know it. Then David Brinkley, John Kennedy, and other dignitaries. I think Bill Weber, the vice president of tech, was with them. And the whole, right past, I was standing at the door because we knew he was coming. Went right by me into the injection molding. It was quite a highlight of my my career.
Yeah.
So, so then by that time, I was in quality control then, but then I got switched over. Oh, I know what happened. They consolidated the ceramics quality control with the plastic quality control. So the man that was from ceramics was Howard Lewis. He took over the job, and I was under him then, and plus another guy was under him, and I was on that job for maybe a couple of 3 months or longer, and then I decided to get into pre-production, where when they first started a new part, plastic part, I would get involved with the making sure the die got made on time and scheduling it. I really enjoyed that job. And that's what I did, pretty much very similar to that till I retired in 1983. It's a fabulous job.
Mm-hmm. So when did you go to Vancouver?
We went to Vancouver about 1981, they decided to build a plastic plant in Vancouver.
Oh, yeah.
And so our whole plant went over there. Well, I shouldn't say whole plant, but by this time plastic was split into two divisions. There was an accessory division, which would had probably a couple of hundred employees, but the main division maybe had 400 or 500, that ratio sort of. So the main plastic division, which was in building 16 on the main campus, moved over to Vancouver. But we people that were in pre-production engineering and engineering stayed in Beaverton and just communicated mostly on phone, but went, oh.
Sorry. No, go ahead.
But mostly we'd do most of our work back and forth. Mm-hmm. Well, on the phone. But then they decided, I would say, I'm trying to get the dates right. I would say in the spring of 82, no, the spring of, the fall of 81, the fall of 81, they said, well, all you guys are going to have to go over there physically. So Barbara and I were started looking around right away for a house and found one. A real nice house, about 4 or 5 miles from work. And we went to work for, I was there, didn't like it at all. They changed management, and the management, I don't know if you want to quote me on this, they brought in a lot of college people that had never had anything to do with running a plastic company. Most of them hadn't even got their hands dirty. Mm-hmm. And my favorite line was that they went to college and learned all the lines, but they didn't learn what was between the lines, which is where it all is. Everything's between the lines. So it was a very unpleasant place because they were asking us to do things that were totally ridiculous so that we couldn't do our job. In fact, in those days we had terminals. We didn't have these desktop computers.
Uh-huh.
They were terminals. You're probably familiar with mm-hmm. them. Tektronix made terminals.
Mm-hmm.
And a terminal company spun off from Tektronix, and I had stock in it for a while. Did real well. So anyway, we had these terminals. So us guys, we were so busy trying to get these parts molded and work with the engineers. And first thing in the morning, we had to spend an hour on learning these terminals. Well, on these terminals, it's not like a keyboard is today. In order to write a simple letter, you had to know a code. You're going to say to somebody. So you had to punch in XYZ31, and then that was two. And then you had to remember something else for from. And you had to remember all that was in the book, of course. It was a book here. It would take you, like an hour, just email, it takes you 30 seconds. It would take somebody, unless you were very experienced, a half an hour to write an email. Mm. So this valuable time, a whole hour, we didn't have 5 minutes to waste. Mm-hmm. And the whole crew, the tooling, the guys that were drawing up the molds, a very sophisticated job, and I was trying to schedule things. And the guy, we had a main plant out at Wilsonville that we were working with engineers there, and they needed parts, and they'd call us up. Well, it's going to be a few days before we get it to you because we're behind, and we couldn't catch up. And then on top of that, they said, we're going to have a quality control course in the afternoon. Well, everybody that was in our group, about 20 in the office type group that I was in, all had worked with quality control for years. We knew more than the teacher did. But they brought in a guy that started from grade one.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of us guys that were designing tools, actually checking quality, working with the engineers, telling them how to design the parts so that we could make it. You know, they can design parts so you can't mold them, can't get them out of the mold. And they're trying to teach us quality control with formulas and stuff. Another hour wasted today. So as time goes by, but there was sort of an act of God that happened. I'm trying to get the date. It would be about Thanksgiving, 1982. We got a letter. I think it was a letter from the president that we were going to downsize. So they came out with this lead balloon program that people usually would call gold balloons. And it looked fairly good. You had to be over 50 and 20 years company time. And what else? 20 years.
You had to work 20 years and you had to be over 50. And I think that was all. And you could take this retirement, early retirement.
I guess that was the main two things. I thought there was another one. Anyway, as it worked out, so I meet that very easily. I'm 54. But everybody else that was over 50, their kids were all through college.
Mm.
I had a boy in grade one, a boy in grade two, and a boy in grade seven. So if I take this early retirement, how can I afford to support this family?
Mm-hmm.
It was a tremendous worry. But also, I'm getting rid of this frustration. And I said, you know, if I don't take this, they're going to fire me in 3 months anyway, because the management thinks that they can hire somebody out of college for half the money that I'm making and do the same job. And they might be computer literate, whereas we guys weren't.
Mm-hmm.
Guys. So I said, you know, so I really agonized over this. If I don't, they're going to, and then I won't even have some of the benefits I'm going to be getting. I forget what, not very much, but some. And so, fortunately, my big ace in the hole was I had started my own plastic company. 9 years earlier, in 1974, just in my garage in Aloha, not far from where we are right now. And I started with the smallest molding machine probably ever commercially made. It was a Simplimatic, and it could only shoot 1/3 of an ounce, which is a very small part. It would be about as big as the end, that much of my, maybe about a part that would be a half inch cube, would be about as big a part as it could shoot. But if you look into electronic instruments, there's a lot of little parts like that. And so before this retirement came, I'd upgraded that. I designed a machine around this one, but much improved, and designed it where it would shoot an ounce. Now, an ounce with the regulation machines is a big machine, but mine wasn't as big as that center cabinet there. I designed a small, powerful hydraulic machine that was air over oil, you called it, where it had a hydraulic clamp, but air injection. Now, what's good about that? One of the secrets of molding, well, I told you one, is have the dry material, which I had dryers. Well, we just used a household oven, but if you watch it, that works. But the other one is fast fill. You want to fill that mold as fast as you can. I put a huge cylinder on this molding machine, which normally would have a cylinder about this big. I had one, and this is a big multiplier. When you go from this to this, it's not twice as much, it's 10 times as much, with a long stroke. And I had an air exhaust system. It was called a quick exhaust system. So that thing would come down, wham, like that, and the mold was full, like that. And then it meant you could have fast cycles. You could run the material colder. That one of the other secrets is run the material as cold as you can, but where it still looks nice. If it gets too cold, it has wrinkles on it. But as soon as you get rid of those wrinkles, that's where you run it. You can run fast, and every part will be good. And the colder you run, the less chance, even if there's moisture in the material, it won't come to the surface. It's just buried in there somewhere. So most people run it too hot. There's moisture comes to the surface, rejects everywhere. Anyway, so I'd planned for that. So it was still operating over here. I had my nephew, Earl Trask. A lot of people let his dad, Warren Trask, sure you get his, was the one that recommended me for Tektronix.
Oh, really?
And gave me, got me down here in the first place and recommended me to Ash Ashenbrenner as a good, reliable person.
Mm-hmm.
And
Earl went on to work at Lattice, didn't he?
Earl later on went to work for a lot of these, you know, Norm Winningstad, you've heard about. Mm-hmm. So many companies separated. And Warren, my nephew, worked for three or four of those. And he got some good experience running my molding company. So anyway, he was between jobs. So when we moved to Vancouver, I was running a little swing shift where he'd come down in the evening. And because I was still working over here, but I mostly worked on weekends and on my home project.
Mm-hmm.
So he'd come every evening and put in about three. By this time, we're getting a few customers. So I would call Earl and say, you know, I'm thinking about taking this early retirement. And do you think we can both maybe survive over there? Well, we seem to think so. But anyway, then, so, yeah, okay, I'm taking my early retirement, which I did.
How many people were eligible for that retirement?
That's a good story. My recollection is it was 900 people eligible that were over 50 and had been 27 years with the company. And anyway, the story I remember is Tech did a survey of other big companies that had offered this same thing. And they found out something like 10% of the people would take it. Well, I mentioned that things were in a downhill mode. 90% of the people took it.
Oh, really?
Not 10%. Wow. So that right there tells you how these old-timers felt about the company. Not just me. And we were all hoping that the company could turn around. But most of us thought they had 24,000 people. We thought all they needed was 16,000. So even getting rid of 1,000 was nothing. Mm-hmm. And it proved that they needed to get rid of way more. Mm-hmm. But so anyway, the time arrives, and oh, what a relief. I just come home, I'm a changed man. Couldn't wait to get up to work again. Uh-huh. But I was driving from Vancouver with this old van we had, what was that, a 62?
Oh yeah, Econo.
Nice old Econoliner. And I drove to work. My family was still there, you see. I drove over each morning, can't wait to get to work, you know. And worked all day, and Earl worked, and I worked. Well, as time went by, there really wasn't enough work for us, and Earl was wanting to, he already had some education, much more than I did, a couple of years of college. Mm-hmm. So there was some opening in, what's the one that John went to? That's
oh, yeah, PCC.
PCC. It was, what was it called?
The program was something to do with processes and wafers.
Circuit boards and wafers, yeah.
Yeah, and,
the wafer.
And he went through that program and he ended up, I think, wasn't he at Planar when he was
Yeah,
there?
But he went as a technician.
Yeah, technician.
Now the technicians, when it comes to hands-on, usually know more than the engineers, because they really learn the hands-on. The engineers know all about the how to figure things out, you know. So he became very successful. He worked for Lattice was one of the places, and Mentor Graphics was it.
I don't know.
And he worked for about three or four places that were all startups from tech and did very well. Rose kind of like I did. There's an expression of that. He rose up to his level of incompetency. Have you heard that expression before? We used it quite a bit at tech.
Uh-huh.
So in my case, the way I used that was I rose to a level that I felt comfortable with. I didn't want to go up where I was over my head. Mm-hmm. So that was me. Now, the people that really get ahead and you got to admire it for them, they go beyond that comfort level and stick it out. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't of that nature. So Earl went on to great things. He's actually retired now at 55, down in Hemet for the winter in San Diego, living a good life, has pensions coming from tech, I expect, and some of these other companies.
Mm-hmm. Well, you didn't drive very long. We moved back here in October.
Well, that was quite a long time.
Yeah.
May,
so
June, July. In October,
it was quite a few months.
And the kids, they were so
happy.
We still had our house. We didn't sell our house,
so
we had the same house.
Back.
Oh, and all their friends, and they went to the same school.
We were only gone about 2 years, so they were thrilled to come back.
But anyway, so everybody was happy. Mm-hmm. So where are we now?
Did you have any friends outside of work that maybe you had a relationship with Tektronix?
Well, yes, Bill. Oh, this is an important story. Bill
Cheshire?
My best friend I ever had in Tektronix. Bill lived over here beside us.
Oh, gosh, I hate not being able to remember names.
He's such a famous guy. Bill, we'll think of it.
And Carolyn? Is
yeah, Bill and Carolyn. What's their last name?
Oh, they'll come to me in a minute.
Anyway,
Benedict.
Bill Benedict. Okay.
Now make a note of his, because I want to tell you when I first met him. Mm-hmm. So when I was in, about the time Kennedy came through. Mm-hmm. So that'd be about 62. I was the unit manager of Plastics Quality Control, range 12 at the time. But I only had three or four people working under me because we were very efficient. People got ahead. They built up big empires and said, well, look at me, I have all these people, I should get paid more. Mm-hmm. Should have been the opposite. we guys that ran efficient should have got paid more. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I digress. So anyway, I had to get some kind of an electronic piece of equipment to check something. Now, I've forgotten what it was. So I called up, and they gave me somebody that built those kind of things. And they gave me a name, Bill Benedict. So he said, oh, I'll be right over. So he came over. The guy, he'd be at the time, I'm not sure if he's even, no, I don't think he's married. At the time, he looked like he was about a little, about my age. Maybe younger, but anyway, he looked the picture of an engineer. Looked very, but he was. I found him extremely shy. I told him what I want. Oh yeah, yeah, and he absorbed it right away. I didn't have to, you know, this and that and the other thing. Okay, he said that's fine, and so he went back to where he worked in Building 50. And the next day, he had this piece of testing equipment for me. So through the years, I think that's the only thing he made for me. But in what year did they build those houses there? In 1980, when we came back, in about 1984.
No, it was before we left. They were built way before we left, weren't they? I think it was before we left, sure.
Yeah, okay, so it's important to me, not you, but
In the 70s, because our kids played with them.
Were they about the same age?
Yeah, our children were the same age as their children.
So I would say, just as a reference, about 1974, they moved into the next street to us in a brand new house. His mm-hmm. wife was Carolyn, and she has a famous brother. The famous brother is Richard Van Grunsven. Mm-hmm. And why he is famous, he makes more airplanes, flyable airplanes, than Boeing does.
Mm-hmm. Kits.
The kits, but they're flyable. You can do these things with mm-hmm. them. And so anyway, being as Bill Benedict's, Bill must have taken retirement when I took retirement.
I think so, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And anyway, we had moved to another house only a few blocks farther, but still close to Bill, you see. And in 1987, that's a few years later. So I needed some wiring done because I'm putting a big molding machine into our big garage there. It was mm-hmm. as long as, well, not as long as this room, half as long. Just like those big ones at Tech that
looked
were so
like a
big.
Freight train engine.
Big, but it could shoot about 6 ounces. So he came over and helped me get it wired and all this stuff, because I had to get more household power. And he would hardly charge. I regret myself that I didn't double whatever he asked.
Didn't he go to work about that time for Vance Aircraft?
Yeah, about it, yeah. And he had a design. He went to manage Vance Aircraft. Hmm. Now, they're over in North Plains. Didn't you know the story mm-hmm. of that, do you?
Yeah.
They're over in North Plains now, and he's the manager. But before he became manager, I taught him how to be a...
molding.
Because he went to work for Davis. Davis is a guy that you
Davis
might want.
Tool.
Davis Tool was a guy that was a real sharp guy.
Ron Davis.
In the model shop department at Tech, where you had to be a superior mold maker. Well, about what time would that be roughly? Probably about 1975. He started Davis Tooling in Hillsboro. Mm. Is it that what it's called,
yeah,
Davis Tooling?
Davis Tooling.
And it was for machining parts, and his big contract was Boeing. And he was one of the first guys that got into CNC, where he could build very complicated parts. In fact, it was before 1983.
They were doing a lot of stuff with that really elaborate metal. What's it called? I remember they had a clean room. They had a clean room where they were doing it.
Yeah.
I saw it one time.
Anyway, you can still go through his plant. He would be an interesting guy to interview, mm-hmm. much more so than me. Anyway, Bill knew about me molding and all. In fact, we made an impossible part for the airplanes. It's the one the pilot will hold on the stick. It's a plastic part. And it has a little hole here in the front where you can put a hook a machine gun up to it, and when you pull that, it shoots the bullets between
they
the props.
They sold
their time.
Those planes to Nigeria or someplace.
Yeah, they got a contract for 100 of these planes to sell to Nigeria, but they needed guns on them. Before that, they didn't have guns. And they had this very sophisticated, where they had places for your fingers to go. Mm-hmm. And they had a wooden model of it. It's all they had. So I took it to another fella that was a genius as far as making things. He's in jail now.
Dave Larson.
You should almost work that in, but you can leave that jail apart. He worked out of his home, and he worked for Tektronix in the model department in Wilsonville. So I took this to him, this wooden thing to him, and he made a mold, very reasonable. I can't believe it. It was about $1,000. A regular big mold maker would have cost us $10,000 for it. So we made this mold, put it in, got the first shot. Sometimes you have trouble with the first. Got the first shot, gave it to Bill.
The thing was, they were very low usage. You know, they just wanted a few hundred parts.
Well, they wanted 100 to start with.
Yeah, but that's low usage for plastic.
Yeah, oh yeah. Mm-hmm. But oh yeah, nobody else likes that small usage.
Yeah, the parts aren't cost anything. It's the mold that costs.
So anyway,
them.
Bill was very happy with that. And he looked through our molding company, and he was a quick learner, so he could see just by looking at it how it works.
Uh-huh.
Top engineer, electronic engineer that was also an electrical engineer. Mm-hmm. A lot of electronic engineers don't know household. It's
mm-hmm.
kind of a different thing, but he knew both. So all of a sudden, Ron Davis needs more help out there. And he was the best friend of Ron Davis. They were just like this. But, like, you know, you go to, he only worked for Ron Davis for a while. And then Ron decided to start a molding business. So he bought brand new sophisticated machines right off the bat.
Mm-hmm.
So, and put Bill in charge of that division. So Bill had me out a couple of times to help him a little bit with what little bit I knew. And also he came to my boys and got a few little ideas. If he had problems, we'd help him. So, but he only worked doing that 6 months. And then he went to work for the airplane guy. And part of it, I think, was, yeah, I think he had a little trouble working with his best friend. Because his best friend wasn't happy till your nose was bleeding. He wanted you to work that hard. And that's the way most people that work for Ron Davis don't last very long. But I remember this guy that came to me.
Oh, what was the guy that used to make
in 1983, when I first came back, I got a call from a fella. He saw my name in this little one line in the phone book. Advertising was so expensive. There was no Craigslist. And he just lived over here behind Amelia's.
And he did some work for us, and we sent him to Davis Tool, and he got a job at Davis Tool.
Well, let me start the story, though.
Yeah,
yeah, he made something for me. So he just worked out of his house. So I could see he was a sharp guy. So anyway, he was almost crying one day because there was a big recession,
mm-hmm.
almost like now,
mm-hmm.
but it didn't last as long. He was almost crying. Well, did I have any work for him? So I did find little things that he could make, little tools that I need, and I'd go over to his house. He had a wonderful wife. I've forgotten about his children, I'm not sure. But anyway, then I'm not sure if he asked me, if I said, you know, and he knew CNC. A lot of people didn't know CNC. So I said, I don't know if I suggested Ron Davis or if he suggested to me.
I said,
and I'll give you a good recommendation, which I did. So he got on, and a few years ago, he was still there. So I told him, boy, with Ron, don't make any mistakes. He'll fire you on the spot, just like that. And so I know 20 years later, in fact, I'm going to go over and see him one of these days.
Yeah, you should.
When we think of his name. but you do want to interview Ron Davis.
Mm-hmm.
But that led me to another name that you want to interview. Who did come up in this conversation. It was Bill Benedict. He died, you know.
Oh, in a plane crash. With his son. He and his son were both killed.
Oh, his son was like, Bill then gradually, at least he wasn't shy. As he came out of that. Maybe it was after he got married or something. And he had the nicest little boy that played
with
my
boy. Same age as our son, yeah.
He was so shy. When I asked him, I'd say, what was his favorite answer? He always had the same answer. I'd ask him something like, what'd you learn in school today, Jeremy? And he'd say nothing. Or it was always a one-word answer because he didn't want it. Now, he played good with my kids, but
that is.
So anyway, he went to PCC, to college. And he got to be the valedictorian there. And he got a little bit political. And he got up where he could make speeches and everything. And part of that was because when he got old enough, he started taking flying lessons.
He went to
his dad
Portland.
Became a pilot,
University
too.
Portland,
and they flew these planes.
Yeah.
And he went... There's a good story on the website about him. You should be able to look it up. Jeremy Benedict. He went over to some place like Manchuria or someplace, and they sold a kit to a guy, and he went over there and showed him how to put it together, and he helped him fly and everything. Interesting story. But then, what was I leading up to here about the plane? Oh, well then... Is it about 8 years ago now?
Oh, yes.
They were flying to Florida, both pilots, Jeremy and his dad. They have their planes, fortunately, sit side by side, which is great.
Yeah.
How to learn, you know. They're flying back to Florida. They used to go to the big place that's called Oshkosh. Have you heard of Oshkosh?
Yeah, I've heard of that.
They flew there every year. But then, and then also to Florida, this place, the same thing. So they're flying, and I think they were going over Kansas. And the farmer in the field said he heard a loud noise and he saw a plane going straight down, bang, into the ground. Well, that was the end of Bill.
It was terrible. I heard it on the radio driving to work because I was still working.
Now, that would be about 10 years ago.
Yeah, so I had to go in and tell my kids, you know, here's this friend of theirs. And, you know, our friend. It was really awful.
But if you want to read about that, you can look that up, too.
Okay.
And anyway, so that was so sad for the family. And they have a sister, too. So sad for her.
What about the guy that was in the wine, that has the winery now?
Oh, John Covey? Was he?
Oh, yeah, you've already interviewed John Covey.
Yeah, I think
they're
going to
interview
him
later this year.
You knew that Howard Vaughan considered him the top engineer of all of the engineers they had.
Wow, really?
And he, I think I told you that he just had a high school education, because that was my story. But then reading elsewhere, I think maybe he had 1 or 2 years of college, but probably PCC.
You know, Lee has a couple of stories about Howard. You should tell that story about him fixing the toaster, because that was
he knows
great
that. That's in the, you read the blue book, didn't you? That's in there, isn't it, about
the
toaster?
That's a great story.
Yeah. But my big hero, and I think you've already read this, the book that... Tippery wrote. Have you read his book?
No.
Miles Tippery. Did you loan that to somebody?
No, I think we still have it, but they have a copy of it at the museum.
Yeah,
there.
I think I've read some excerpts from it.
Yeah, well, the thing is, I was wondering if Howard at the end might have got dementia. Have you seen his last interview that was on TV, Channel 10?
Maybe, yeah, I think.
Well, you can look that up again. But when he talks about starting the company, unless they had a fallout, he never mentions Miles Tipperary, once Tippery. And he mentions quite firm that the people that started the company was he and Jack and the other two fellas that I just momentarily forgot, two other fellas. So I'm thinking that he and Miles must have had a falling out. And it could possibly be, you know, I told you about Blanche Cook being the one that was in personnel at well, I didn't know it at the time, but her boss was Mrs. Tippery. She was over personnel. But they might have left. They left Tech, I think, maybe a year before we come, so she would have gone. What happened? Did you ever hear the story about the mysterious sickness in Portland in 1953? Oh, this is part of your story. You got to get this in. Well, you know Bob Davis. He was one of the top guys. He was in the Coast Guard too, like Howard Vaughan, or not Howard Vaughan, but Murdoch and Tippery and Davis were all in the Coast Guard.
Okay. Yeah.
Anyway, you can read about this somewhere, because I might not have it exact. But Bob Davis had this beautiful wife that I think was 23 years old. And they just started at Tech, maybe a couple of years. He was high up right away because of his background. And she died at 23. There was a mysterious disease came to Portland, Oregon. I don't think anywhere else. And there was maybe three or four people died from this. And they didn't know what it was. They were testing it. And what happened was Miles Tippery got the same thing, what they thought it was the same thing. He didn't die. But all of a sudden, he couldn't work. He got so... He had just built a house where the hospital is now, right across Barnes Road. Mm-hmm. Got a hell of it. Bought 5 acres, so built a beautiful house. And then he got this disease where it's all downhill, and he could walk on about like this to go to work. So this went on, and he wasn't getting any better. And he was from the old school, at least in his book, that he said, the old school, you can't, he was vice president mm-hmm. of something, and he was one of the old school that couldn't take a big paycheck without doing something. So this was causing him mental anguish. But I'm wondering if maybe he hadn't had a little fallout with Howard about the same time because of the fact that Howard doesn't mention his name. So I think Jack was still living there. I think he was more of a... But you've heard of Earl, remember Earl's last name? Earl, have you come across another Earl, big, high guy, Earl? Anyway, he was a kind of a confidant. And Earl told him about a place for sale up on, what's that island you went to?
In the San Juans.
Do you know that story?
Mm-hmm.
I went to.
Yeah,
you know,
I think
he bought
that.
So this Earl guy got him onto that. So he sold this property mm-hmm. and went up there. And I believe that when I came back, went to work at Tech in 56, I remember going into the lunchroom, and it sticks in my mind that Miles Tippery had come back and made a little talk to the people about how the company got started. Mm-hmm. I'm quite sure it was him, but it doesn't show up in any of the literature I've read.
Mm-hmm.
A very impressive guy, little guy, but impressive. So we've gone off on an awful lot of tangents. Where are we?
I was wondering if you participated in any of the training programs that Tektronix...
Well, you know...
Don't you remember MTM?
MTM.
One?
Oh, yes. What was that?
Motion time.
That was the beginning of the down. I went to MTM. You know what that is?
Motion time.
Well,
management.
The way we... I was in quality control, but also... one example, they had molding machines. Not near as good as mine, but that's another story. The girl would be sitting here when I first started, and they had a small mold, because there were a lot of small parts. Heavy. It weighed 2 or 3. She had to slide it into the molding machine, push a button, and it would close, and then push another button. And in about a minute, it would open, and she'd pull it out. And a heavy die, she would pull apart and get the part out. And at the end of the day, I don't know why that Morton didn't have carpal. But it wasn't a word that wasn't popular. Now everybody has carpal.
Yeah.
I don't remember anybody having carpal. And they were doing the same sorts of things. Anyway, so we would time them. The best operator that they had, you know, they'd have maybe 4 girls running these machines. So we'd go to the best operator and watch her and break down the time. And so, okay, this girl could get 60 parts an hour. Well, standards are always usually higher than you expect to meet, but they're standards. So we'll say 60 parts an hour. So if you made 50 parts an hour, you were within the standard. So you always set the standard a little bit high. So this happened about the time Earl Wantman took over as president, I think. Anyway, and the chief engineer. What was the... one of the top guys over the engineers, can kick out a few names for me, was this guy. I'm sure he's a sharp guy, but he wanted to go sophisticated. So sophisticated that that ruined the quality control department, because you're trying to work with ordinary people and teach them sophisticated techniques that in no way will they understand. Even we supervisors had trouble with it. And so it was all screwed up instead of doing a simple system that worked. We didn't have a problem. We had rejects, but a tolerable level. So anyway, they set this mess, this program up where I had to go to it and a bunch of other sort of key people, some of the lead men on the floor, a little above an average working person. And we took the, so the MTM,
Motion Time Management.
I remember it so well.
Here's
this girl on the machine. I forget where we start, but we'll start with it. Here's the mold. First of all, well, here's the mold. We'll start with it right in front of her. So, okay, then the machine opens. She's starting fresh. So it takes her 6 inches to slide that in. So to slide something weighing a half a pound, 6 inches, according to books, it takes 3 seconds. Then she has to reach 8 inches down to push a button. And now to reach with your hand 8 inches, it takes 2 seconds. And then you do the, so you add all this up. So the cycle is 60 seconds, maybe the same, but probably not. Probably way more in reality. So then, when new products come on the line, that's the way they did it. So they would make a new mold. Mm-hmm. So then there'd be a girl out there studying how long it took to mold, because this is a bigger mold, a different way. So pathetic. Because number one, the mold person doing the molding is maybe a beginner. But the one doing this was sort of a graduate. She's pretty sharp. And then to add it all up, make sense of it, somebody interrupted the thing. And so this went on. That is one of the first moves that sent tech in this. That's probably why they had to hire so many people instead of 16 to do all of this kind of stuff. Because they were doing it all over the company, not just the injection molding, the sheet metal everywhere. Pathetic. Better not quote me on this.
Well, one of the things that I remember when we were living in Vancouver is I had went in a few times to the plant to pick Lee up or for some reason, and you would go into the back and they would have like, I don't know how many machines they
about
had.
About
20 machines. And then you would go into the front part and there was just this sea of desks. Hundreds of desks. Well, you know, one machine can only
at least 60.
One machine can only support so many desks.
I would guess we only had 15 machines and would have at least 80 support personnel. Mm-hmm. And it should be the other way around. You aren't supporting
mm-hmm. those many people with those machines.
In our place that we run now, a highly sophisticated company, you got to come out and see it. Mm-hmm. We have 13 almost new with robots, new machines, we have 13 employees. And
plus management, you're talking about.
Well, three management. And those they're not each running a machine. They're doing secondary work, trimming parts and stuff like that, shipping them, all that. There's about five guys on average that are running these 13 machines. So we have a ratio of almost 1-to-1. So theoretically, if we had 15 machines there, maybe even give them 30 people in the office, not 100, whatever it was.
Yeah.
But that wasn't just us. That was all. They'd moved a plant into Wilsonville, same thing.
Yeah.
Highly inefficient.
Maria was an engineer?
Yeah, and a sharp engineer.
Okay. Were there a lot of women that worked on the floor?
Quite a few. They were very good. Now, I was going to backtrack a little bit. When I first went to tech with 1,000 people, everybody was just a first-class person you could visit with. But then a program came along where they had to hire so many disadvantaged people, which was a good program. But we got lots of people, good workers and everything, but you'd start hearing a lot of swear words. Mm. When I first went there, you didn't hear anybody swear. I don't think you could smoke on the job. There was hardly any smokers. Mm-hmm. My lead man, Ivan Arnold, who I mentioned, bought a new car. And he also took people, what do you call them when you take people with you?
Oh, carpool.
Carpool. And he said, hey, with my new carpool, there's no smoking in this car. Well, at that time, that was kind of, you know, he was kind of a hard nose to say that. Mm-hmm. He was ahead of his time in so many ways. Mm-hmm. But then gradually the swearing came in. You had more people that were drinkers. You know, you can tell drinkers if they're excessive drinkers, mm-hmm. just mm-hmm. by the way they look. And the overall, I shouldn't say the quality of the
morale
people.
Maybe too.
Well, the morale goes down with that. Yeah, yeah. So gradually, naturally, when you have 24,000 people, huh, mm-hmm. you can't mean, because at first they could be very selective, you know. And then gradually the government sort of, here we're selling all, most of our scopes are going to the government, so yeah. you got to hire, in fact, we hired people that got out. In my group, there was a guy that was a murderer. Huh. He got out several, and they were he was a sharp mathematician. He was, when I was in the, I wish I could think of his name, it wasn't his real name. Huh. And I was one of the few people that, because I was actually, there was Howard Lewis that was over me, and then I was over him. And Howard Lewis and I, and top management, were the only ones that knew he was a murderer. For the life of me, I can't remember his name. I'm going to look up Howard Lewis sometime. But a good worker, so it was certainly a case. I think his big thing, that he held up a train. In the old days, you know, he was an old guy. At that time, he was probably 60, and I was maybe 30 at that time. And so he might have been the guy that held up that famous train and in the holdup, they managed mm-hmm. to murder a couple of people. But anyway, we're way off base here.
Why do you think the high-tech industry has worked in Washington County and stayed here?
Very obvious. It's so obvious. It's because they've got to start from tech. Mm-hmm. And all of these startup companies and the government, the Democratic government, supports all. They bought in all these schools to support Tektronix and Norm Winstadt's company. And Intel is always supportive of technology, state of the art. Mm-hmm. It's tech and Intel, Norm Winstadt, Howard Vaughan, and all the, even Earl Wantland, all those guys.
And don't you think that tech encouraged little startups too?
Oh, well, the other thing was they did. I stayed away from classes or whatever you call it, because I wanted to work. I was probably not a good employee. I wanted to do a good job for 8 hours and go home, have free time, not go to classes, not anything, not have to think about work tomorrow, because I tried to keep my job simplified. Mm-hmm. So your answer, I only took about that one course. I took a little drafting class once. Mm-hmm. About that size. But that was one of the things they succeeded. Mm-hmm. Oh, the big thing is, you could take anything. If I'd wanted to take an electronic course, Tektronix would have paid for it. Mm-hmm. Or if I wanted to learn more about CNC, injection or not, but to make the mold, we'll pay for it. Mm-hmm. You just put your, come back in, maybe later on they might have been little charged, I don't know. But that, it was down to education and the guys that started Tektronix. I guess you probably knew that Intel almost didn't occupy this building right down here, the first one. You don't know that story, yeah. Okay.
Were a lot of your clients today some of those spinoffs from Tektronix?
I built up. My big client was the dental industry. Did I already tell you that story?
No.
Well, anyway, then when I came back in 83, I knew I had to get business. So every day, I looked in the phone book and any We didn't have resources like the Google now that you have mm-hmm. and all that. But anywhere I could look up the trade magazines or anything, because we did get those, a plastic trade magazine that had ads in it and stuff, and information about how to mold, and names of companies perhaps. So I happened to one day, so I'd call five people on the phone a day, and so many of them were interested, and none of them were impolite. And so I got hold of this Maris Dental. Is that what it was called then?
I think so. Well, I don't know if it was called that, but I think so.
Yeah, Maris Dental in Bend. Have you heard of Maris Dental?
No.
Well, they were a spinoff of, what's the company that makes the valves over
there? I'll think of it in a second.
No, so much. Anyway, they were a spinoff of a company, and you'll know the name. That makes valves and stuff. So a dentist,
Williams Air Control.
And they started up right after the war. So if you go into a dentist's office, they have all this air equipment blowing out stuff, and mm-hmm. they have water that goes along. So there's a lot of electronic plastic parts, I should say. And so I got a hold of the purchasing agent there, a very nice guy. And he and his chief mechanical engineer came into my little shop in the back. By then, I had my first machine and two homemade machines that could produce pretty big parts by my standards. So they came in, and especially the engineer. He was a hands-on guy. He just loved my little shop because he had grown up doing things. He didn't just go to college. In fact, I'm not sure if he went to college. And so right away he liked, and we hit it off right away. So then by that time I maybe was making a part, or maybe they came in for the first part. I don't remember that. But they went back, and pretty soon, every week or so, I'll show you some of the parts sometime, made some parts for him, little parts. And then I got a very sophisticated part. I wish I had time to.
Oh, that.
You know, out where my drill press is, honey?
That clear one?
Where my drill press is, I have all those. And get the one with the threads in it.
Oh, yes.
So I make a part. Now, if I'm going on to get me off this tangent, would you like?
All right, no.
A part this big around and this long with about an eighth-inch wall thick. And it had threads in it. Now, it's like the threads on a thermos bottle. They're not tight threads. They're mm-hmm. very coarse threads. Well, my little reason for my little success, not compared to the big guys, little success, was when these people would call me, Maris in particular, they'd say, well, can you, we need a screw machine part. Can you make that? Oh, yeah, I can do it. Or we need a sheet metal part. Yeah, I can do it. So, with my resources from tech, I knew guys that had left, and they had bending machines, they had screw machines. Mm-hmm. So that made it easy for them. I would get these sorts of parts made. So we got this big part that's too big for your machine. Oh, that's okay. I'll make the mold, and I'll get it farmed out, and we'll mold it. So it was about a 2-ounce part, close to 2 ounces. And my homemade machine would only go up to 1 ounce. So they just sent me a complex drawing, and maybe a part. I'm not sure if they had a part or not. So I took it to this same mold maker that I told that worked out of the shop. He gave me a hell of a good deal on it. Unbelievable. And so I made it, and I had a guy, M&M Molding, over in the Selwood District. Took it over to him. It was a nice molding. Put it in. But it was unscrewing. Now, when you have to unscrew a part, first of all, you got to put a lot of mold release on it so it'll unscrew. So he didn't do it while I was there. Unfortunately, I was home. He said, oh, we can't do this. He said, we got two shots, and it's just too much trouble. And I went out and tried to tell him how he could do it. No, he got negative. So I picked up this mold. It was probably the most expensive mold I'd ever made to this time, $2,000 or $3,000. Most of my molds were under $1,000. And I said, if I can't do this,
We're in trouble.
Well, just set it down here. I'll get that one. I won't get into all these other ones. Anyway, it doesn't matter. It was about this size.
I'll find it.
It was about this size. It doesn't matter. But weighed twice as much. I could have molded this on my 1 ounce machine. So I looked at my 1 ounce machine and said, I gotta do this. So I was able, I looked at my, I told you about this big cylinder that came down.
Mm-hmm.
So at that time, I only had a cylinder this big. So I planned ahead, and I had lots of big air cylinders. So I said, you know, if I took this big cylinder and put it up there and made it a long stroke, it might be able to shoot out 2 ounce part. And this machine, I said, just might be able to. So I took the weekend and did that, got that off. Because also, just a couple of miles from me was a real sharp machinist that could cut that thing down to make it the right height and hook up to it and stuff. So I went over and he did a lot of work for me, so he gave me priority. So over the weekend I got this done. And then to adapt, had to do some things here to get this bigger, to set this big mold in there. So okay, I do it manually, do everything, not automatic. Close the mold, get the clamp, builds up pressure, and then fire that, bang! I put a lot of mold resist on it. Yeah, the part's all there. And oh, it's so hard to get off, oh God. But I could do it just with my hands. So I said, wait a minute. And it was a certain color. It was called, do you remember the color?
Oh yeah,
it was an
some
interesting
kind of gray color.
Color. Yeah, it was an interesting color.
Yeah, I cannot find it.
Chinchilla gray was the color.
Oh yeah, chinchilla gray.
So I had to order.
Marvin is a gray one right there under that box on the
side. So it cost a lot of extra money to order material that had the color in it.
Mm-hmm.
But I had to bite the bullet and buy 100 pounds, which would be twice the price 100 natural pounds would be. But also, this was ABS. This is ABS here.
Mm-hmm.
Nice hard material. But I said, you know, if we ran that out of polypropylene, we have some of that that would unscrew easy. So I got a hold of some the bag of polypropylene with chinchilla gray and put it in there and purged out the other stuff. And bang, open up, take my hand and screw it. But later on, I even made a little device to make it easier. Just come out, and they said, yeah, polypropylene doesn't make it. In fact, it's better. Because they can wipe it off better. It doesn't, mm-hmm. very, very just slippery, you know. So that's the story of that. We made a lens there. I stuck my neck out to make that on my small machine. That's for a backup light for a...
for a Corvair?
No, not a Corvair, but a Falcon.
Oh.
About Ford? A 62 Ford Falcon. Huh. Like. Now that is hard to make.
Yeah.
It has this kind of thing there.
Remember these?
We made 100
million of those.
This was the first part that I made for Maris. In fact, there's about five little
dental
companies around. And they all know one another because all of them worked at that company.
Oh, yeah, Williams Air.
Williams Air. So when they found out I was making these I started making them for Forrest. Mm-hmm. Forrest Medical. It was a little guy that had a small... And then Maris found out about it, so they made them. And then Maris made the similar thing, but just a slight change. But see how easy these are? Now, this was too big to run on my original third, but I could just kick these out every 30 seconds, just like that. And then there was a smaller size. Well, eventually we made a 50-cavity die. So on my bigger machines, we could sit 50 of these at a time.
Yeah, where they cut off.
And then they automatically cut off. So we, I supported all the kids in the neighborhood, this Jeremy Benedict.
Yeah.
They would, I pay them by the piece like a tenth of a penny a part. So those kids could just go,
because they were paying. Off so
they'd
fast.
Make,
they'd
they make,
would race to
they'd
see
make
who could
minimum
do it
wage or better. Every kid in the neighborhood, they'd come over, got anywhere, because they were making these by the 20,000 maybe,
so
wow.
or more. And then they went to different ones. And then they would turn these little things too. But you see, with kids, they'd, and they could watch TV. We had TV then. But if you paid them by the hour, it would cost me more. But that worked out, and it taught them all. My son John did a lot of pruning
because he wanted money. He was really fast.
He could just take that.
He was really fast.
Just like that.
Wow.
So I'm proud of that.
That's the thing they would all think
I'm most proud
of.
All of those kids, I taught them how to work.
Yeah.
Uh huh.
It's true. It's the best thing.
Maybe about a dozen kids in the neighborhood. When they were 10 years old.
Wow.
So look at this as like the history of our life here.
Yeah.
But that is something you should mention about tech. All of these companies around here were guys that left tech. And they hired people, they trained people. So, again, all these people, why the electronic companies coming here, there's people that can do things here.
Yeah.
In Oregon. Such a nice place to live.
Did Jim Callender work at Tech too?
Yes, he did. Another one of my friends. I was so happy to step off the plane, and it was raining and about 40 degrees was it?
Yeah, when we came back,
after 2 weeks
the
off,
air smelled really crisp and fresh. That was nice, but
excellent.
It was cold.
Yeah. Well, I think we're about ready to wrap up and everything.
Yeah,
if you have
bored you to death.
No, not at all. It's been fascinating. And I really appreciate being able to see some of this stuff, too.
If you want to clarify anything, I'm as close as your computer or phone.
Okay.
I'm usually easier to get on the computer. Do you have our card and all that?
I have your contact information.
LB Mason 1.
If you ever have time, you should give us a call and we'll take you out to our plant. You can go through it.
Yeah, that would be really
interesting. Oh, you would enjoy my plant.
It's so different than when we were in our little tiny building behind our house. Now we have this great big 10,000 square foot building.
We only work Monday through Thursday. We instigate the 10-hour day, days a week. Our employees all like
it. And we're very unique because there are very few companies that don't run 24/7 in plastics, and we just run 4 days a week, and we shut it off at night and go home.
Then we did the same thing that Tektronix did. We shut down between Christmas and New Year's and pay our employees for it.
Oh, wow.
And they've never been... Well, we've let employees go, so I suppose they've gone on unemployment.
There was one lady that's working for us now that she said she was working for some other company and they were working a lot of overtime and she has children and she said she just hated working so many hours. And she said when she heard about a company that only worked 4 days a week, she said she couldn't go fast enough to apply.
We have all practically all national. We have Spanish people from Guatemala and Mexico, and one other country down there.
It's El Salvador.
We have a man from Vietnam. We have a Japanese fellow that was born over here. The Vietnam guy was born in Vietnam. And we have, do we have an American Indian? I guess we don't.
I don't think so.
It seems like there's some other race. Well, we have these.
But it's like the United Nations.
A few white guys, too. Do you know we only have one white guy on the floor? Not, you know, Mexicans are brown, aren't they? You call Mexicans. That would be Kevin.
Yeah.
You realize that?
So how many women do you have?
Maybe a little better than 50%.
Half.
All hard workers. I don't know how they do it. We have a little rule at our company that might sound not too good to people. Nobody sits. Everybody stands. Even the officers of the company. Except we have a lunch room.
There's no chairs.
Because my youngest son studies that stuff and read articles where don't provide chairs. It's people, like a lot of people are sitting down when they're working.
Yeah,
but they're slow to get up to open gates, and it's significant at the end of the day.
Well, and the
and they get a break every 2 hours.
You're a little more alert if you're standing up and if you're sitting down, and you know when you're running a machine, you have to be really alert. The machine.
And you can walk back and forth, and you're right there standing where you can push a button if a red light comes on, you know, to stop things.
Yeah,
and you can walk back and forth in front of the machine, you know, get a little, just a step or two makes a big difference in how you feel at the end of the day.
Except for me, I get a stool if I'm running a machine. I don't have to do it anymore.
So there is another
crisis for me.
There is a couple other companies you should talk to, and that's the guy that runs, you know, my other friend that rose quite high. He's got a big company. Quality Plastics, what's his name?
Okay, let me think a minute.
The reason I wanted to talk to him, he worked for the first molder in Portland. And he's a guy probably my age. Lee Dundas. Leland, actually, but we called him Lee Dundas, D-U-N-D-A-S. And his company now is called 3D Plastics. It's in Newburgh. He's got his two sons running it, a highly sophisticated company. At one time, he was real big with lots of employees, mm-hmm. but then he sold that, and the people he sold it to went bankrupt in a couple of weeks.
No,
kind of like
that
Tektronix plant I was telling you what went out
of
business. And they thought they could run it, but no, Leland built it up. And his two sons are running the company now, so if you might even enjoy going out to Newburgh and interview. And the other one is this guy at, you know, he's in Wilsonville now. Vision Plastic.
Oh, Vision.
You know his name? Just give me one more second, because he's an important guy for a couple of reasons.
They do blow molding, don't they?
No, they're highly sophisticated.
But don't they do rotational molding, too?
I don't think so. They might.
I thought they did.
I'll come up with his name in about 30 seconds. The story on the fellow, while I'm thinking about his name, he's the first guy going way back to about the time Kennedy came through, so let's say 64. He came into my pre-production area and wanted some information. He was a young guy, at least 10 years younger than me. And right away, you meet certain people.
Mm-hmm.
I said, this guy is smart, to myself, just by the questions he was asking. So then I asked him a few, and he was about the first guy at Tektronix that learned how to make molds using CNC. So, and he's just a young guy, just out of college. And so, brilliant. So he worked for Tech and started his own company. Vision Plastics is the name of his company. And he's in Wilsonville and got big, big contracts. It was very high priced because he realized he could get it. I didn't care for that for him. He was really ripping Tektronix off. But don't say that. After I retired and got a fairly sophisticated bit, they sent me a few jobs. But this fella, they came out. There's another big mistake they made, if you can bear with me. The head of merchants says, look, there's a dozen molding companies we're doing business with. Let's cut it down to a couple. It's too many. We'll cut it down to two and then really closely watch. Well, we were the ones that got cut out. And this Vision Plastics and one. And these guys just for setting up a machine, $500. I'd have done the same thing for $100. In fact, I did. But the news theory was you work with a couple of companies and then you kind of watch what they're doing. And the buyers know nothing about molding. When they say it's $500 to set up this little part, they don't know that they got it set up in 10 minutes because they know nothing about it.
Mm-hmm.
So they hire buyers for plastic parts that know nothing. Now, the good ones in the old days used to go out and they get explained, this great big mold. Well, how long does that take you to set up? Oh, about 3 hours. Well, this little one, 20 minutes. Well, then on these little parts, it should be $30 to set up, which was about what we charged. Big one, $100. But anyway, Ron Stevens, R-O-N-S-T-E-V-E-N-S. Now, one reason where he got a lot of money to expand his business, he married the daughter, I guess it would be, of the guy that runs Shiloh Inns.
Hmm.
You know Shiloh Inns?
Yeah.
Very successful businessman. In fact, did he also run Hollywood?
I don't know.
But I don't know if it was his daughter or if it was some relation that kind of bankrolled him.
Hmm.
Money was no object. Well, if you can build a state-of-the-art plant, you're going to get business.
Hmm.
We started, I told you about that molding machine. I'm starting to boast. I got to watch that. This is just for you. I bought this molding machine for $200. Did I already tell you that? And that's the only money we ever put into the company.
Wow.
We never borrowed a nickel. It all came from these little profits that we made from Maris and building up the business, building up the... It all, it still does. Now, for the first, from when I came back in 83 till 98, I sort of stepped slightly aside, although I'm still the chief executive. The average was 30% per annum. But not only was it an average, it never went below 25 every year. And then since then, they've maintained that thing and gone up even higher some years. But I think the average is still 30%, which is a pretty hard record to beat.
Yeah.
I don't think they can grow much more without losing their minds.
Oh, we don't want it. Our big problem is holding it, like Tektronix shut it down.
Mm-hmm.
They never should have, number one, they never should have gone on the stock exchange. Then the stockholders started running the company instead of the people. That was the kiss of death when they went on the stock market. Believe me. So we're fighting. You see, what's happened, you should have lots of customers. We're down to practically one customer that does 90% of our business. Because he pays us all the time and gives us more jobs. We can't turn him down. He has his own molding company, Wilson Sporting Goods. They have their own molding company, but they send the stuff to us because of the service. So we, with this Lee Dundas, say we gathered up about 30 molds and just sent to Lee Dundas. Normally, when you do that, you say, okay, when you do that, send us 10% or something.
Mm-hmm.
Glenn, I think he made a mistake. We could hit hard time. He just gave them. They couldn't believe it, these Dundas boys, Lee Dundas' son.
Yeah,
I'm kind of happy we did, because
yeah, we gave them all the
it worked out,
business.
And they're servicing our guys. We didn't want to let them down, send them to some guy that would rip them off.
Wow.
So now that you found the way, come on out more often.
Yeah, well, I want to thank you very much for
it's
giving me your time and your thoughts. And yeah.
When you have time, we'll drive out to Aurora now is where they build the planes. Have you been out there at all?
Yeah, actually.
Oh, you've
have.
Been there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.